Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering local connections to groundbreaking innovations in the field of brain cancer research.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Another first-of-its-kind innovation from Kingston Health Sciences Center and Queen's University. A new 3D-printed surgical biopsy tool is changing the way scientists approach glioblastoma, a uniquely difficult-to-study and aggressive form of brain cancer. Neurosurgeon scientists and assistant professors Dr. James Persner and Dr. Teresa Persner, along with Queen's Engineering PhD candidate Caitlin Andrews, designed and patented a 3D surgical biopsy capsule, a tool used to take small tissue samples from brain tumors with precision. Published recently in the journal Operative Neurosurgery, this breakthrough has the potential to transform how brain tumors are studied and treated. Potential applications include more targeted radiation treatments, more precise and safer surgical decision-making, and new drug development informed by the most comprehensive molecular profiles of glioblastoma to date. Dr. Teresa Persner and engineering PhD candidate Caitlin Andrews sat down to share more about the development of this innovative tool.
Well, to get started, glioblastoma, it's incredibly complex. I was wondering if you could describe what makes this cancer so uniquely difficult to study.
Yeah, it's a really, of all the cancers that I've tried to study, including pediatric and adult brain cancers, for me, it's by quite a margin the most difficult one to tackle, to even conceive of how we start tackling, let alone to tackle. And there's a few reasons for that. So first of all, it's really heterogeneous. So it's made up of many different types of populations of cells. And unfortunately, we've shown that those different types of cells can actually convert between each other. And so you can think you're trying to find a target that you target with a drug. If that target can change at any time in response to your drug, it makes it very difficult. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it's already all over the brain at the time of diagnosis. So if you look at an MRI, you see this round, bright circle, which is the tumor. But we know that back, you know, a long time ago, in the early days of neurosurgery, they actually took out the entire half of the brain that had the tumor in it, and it still came back on the other side of the brain. So it means that it's disseminated at diagnosis. And while, you know, there's this protective barrier in the brain called the blood-brain barrier that stops drugs and, you know, and toxins and bad things from getting into the brain. So it's good for your brain health. But when you're trying to get drugs into the brain, it prevents it from getting there. So where that big primary tumor is, that barrier is broken down. But for the rest of the brain, it's still very much intact. And so those are sort of the three reasons why this is just an incredibly difficult cancer to fight.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps this will be more for Caitlin, but I was wondering if you could explain in simple terms what this new 3D printed biopsy capsule is and what kind of impact it's going to have on research and treatment.
Absolutely. So as you said, it's a small 3D printed capsule. And the way it kind of works is that it adapts to the tip of pre-existing surgical suction. And then there's a little piston on the inside. And so when the suction's applied, the piston gets pulled up and that traps a sample of brain in the capsule itself. We can actually correlate our sample locations to the preoperative scans through intraoperative neuronavigation. So we can mark each point where the samples are taken from, and it's fully self-contained. So there's no cross-contamination between the samples at all. There's no risk of it damaging. It holds the integrity of the sample together. And that allows us to have like a very clear picture of that exact precise sample location going forward for research, which anyone who does genomics or transcriptomics research understands is very important. The more information we have and the less risk of contamination, the better our sample quality. And so all these factors together really let us have a very precise view of the different regions of the tumors that we're interested in, which is something that we haven't been able to really do easily with standard technologies. It could be done in not the safest ways, which obviously patient priority is our safety, or is our priority. Patient safety is our priority. But so it allows us to safely capture all these samples in a quick and efficient way that's not too much of a stress for the surgical team. So always the goal is shortest operation possible with as little risk to the patient as possible.
Mm-hmm. And are you guys already using this in your research right now?
Yeah, so we've used it in 2 patients so far. In our publication, we had a clinical validation where we used it versus the standard of care in a human glioblastoma tumor. And we've since also used it for other cases, and we're hoping to expand its use through the next year.
Mm-hmm. And I know the process of getting something patented is quite a journey. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that, how it all kind of began and how your team ended up here where you're now using this in research.
Yeah, I think it is. So device development can be a really long and arduous journey, especially getting it from concept to human. And so we were just very thoughtful from the very beginning on how we developed it, so that we developed it in a way that would ultimately be safe for human use. And acceptable from an ethics perspective. So from the very beginning, when we were designing the capsule itself, we took into account things like, you know, are these FDA approved materials? Are we creating it in a way that is very simple and easy to use with humans? And then when it came to IP, you know, what is the IP landscape? Are there devices out there that are very similar to ours that would preclude us from eventually filing a patent? And so from the very initial design steps, we took into account the eventual commercialization and the human readiness of the materials we were using. And so we got to human use very, very quickly, I think, because the end goal was embedded in the very initial design process.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think it means for Kingston Health Sciences Center and Queens to kind of be at the center of this global first innovation?
I think it's great. Yeah. I think Kingston's a small town in a lot of regards, right? And so Queens kind of, you know, it punches above its weight with Queens. And so whenever we can sort of raise a flag and say, hey, we're doing something innovative and novel, it just puts us on the global stage. I think it's great, and I think that the more innovation we can do, the more, you know, kind of first that we can do, it also creates greater confidence in the patient population that they're going somewhere that has all the technology and all the resources and expertise required to receive, you know, exceptional care. And for me, at the end of the day, I love science. It's, you know, it's one of my favorite parts of my whole job is doing science, but I'm here for the patients, right? And to build that confidence in them, and to see their confidence in us and our program from a clinical perspective, but also an innovation perspective, it's very gratifying.
Yeah. And I'm curious, Caitlin, since you're still a student, how does it feel to, you know, have this tool that you worked on being out there?
Yeah, it's definitely been a really interesting experience to be a part of. The tool development all started during my undergrad. I've been at Queens for far too long now. And getting to see it move through the stages, like, at the speed that it did, to now having used in patients, it's really been an amazing experience, to be honest. And it's an amazing team to have worked with, everyone from Jamie and Teresa, who are obviously like the spearheads of campaigning for it and helping with its development and providing all the user feedback, to even the other neurosurgeons. So in the early stages, when we were doing preclinical validation, we had the neurosurgery team here compare, as well as grad students, between the standard of care tools and our novel tool, using porcine brain as our model. And so getting everybody's actual feedback from not just Jamie and Teresa, but the actual, like, every member of the neurosurgery team here is a really unique opportunity. So it's been super interesting to be a part of, and I'm super grateful for the opportunity to have taken part in it.
Mm-hmm. And moving forward, you're building those partnerships with other hospitals, hoping to get this tool out there. What are your hopes for the next few years in this department?
I mean, so the tool was developed to do science, right? We didn't develop the tool because we just wanted a tool. We wanted a tool so that we could access tissue in a way and with a granularity and precision that wasn't otherwise possible. And so now the next 5 years, part of it will be, you know, if other people want the tool, more than happy to share it. We create it in a way where it's 30 cents a capsule. And we can literally send off an email to another institution. They can print it off. And we actually did that. We tried it with SickKids, and they printed off some of our capsules, right? So it's extremely mobile. We'd be delighted to share it with anyone. But what I'm really excited about is now the science that will come out of it. So it's kind of a little bit TBD. We'll see what happens. But that it was built to do science, not just to be a tool in itself.
Once again, that was neurosurgeon scientist Dr. Teresa Persner and Queen's Engineering PhD candidate Caitlin Andrews on a new 3D printed surgical biopsy tool changing the way scientists approach glioblastoma. As Persner and Andrews mentioned, the capsule is already being used in operating rooms at KHSC, making Kingston the only medical center in the world currently using this new tool. As for what comes next, the Kingston team is now building partnerships with other hospitals across Ontario to expand its reach. Work is also underway to build a state-of-the-art tissue bank facility that can store samples from patients across Canada, positioning Kingston as a global hub for brain tumor research. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about a possible bag tag reduction in the town of Greater Napanee.
Thank you, Jesse. In a statement released Wednesday, November 26th, the town of Greater Napanee announced that next year's budget will include a recommendation to reduce the town's special levy for waste collection by approximately $50. The proposed change reflects savings expected from provincial legislation, which shifts responsibility for recycling from municipalities to producers beginning in January 2026. According to the town, the removal of municipal responsibility for recycling is expected to save roughly $450,000 in 2026. This proposed reduction stems from a budget directive issued by Mayor Terry Richardson under the provincial government's strong mayor powers, which require the mayor to set budget priorities. His directive calls for any savings from changes to the waste collection system to be returned directly to ratepayers rather than being placed in reserves or used elsewhere. The announcement followed a tense debate at the most recent council meeting on Tuesday, November 25th, at which staff presented a report on the town's waste management contract and 2026 funding model. Staff asked council to approve an amended agreement with Waste Management of Canada Corporation that was reviewed earlier in closed session. First introduced as a paper bag system to encourage waste reduction, the program was replaced in 2024 when the council decided to issue 50 tags per household and add a $200 charge to property tax bills. Despite significant public opposition, the policy continued into 2025. For 2026, Christy Kelly, Director of Environmental Services, said the process would remain the same. Households will receive 50 bag tags in January, and the levy will appear on the final tax installment. The cost change reflects the fact that the municipality will no longer handle curbside recycling. Kelly explained that the amended waste management contract is required because the company will no longer collect recycling. Although recycling costs will be eliminated, she noted that garbage collection rates are now locked in through 2029 to provide predictable budgeting. She said staff therefore recommend passing the savings directly to residents by reducing the levy to $150. Councillor Bob Norrie was the first to object. While he supported amending the waste management contract, he firmly opposed voting on anything that could affect the 2026 budget before seeing the full document. Chief Administrative Officer Matthew Grant attempted to clarify, telling council the vote was only to determine whether the proposal should proceed to budget deliberations. Councillor Mike Shanks said he was uncomfortable approving contract changes and forwarding a levy reduction recommendation before reviewing the draft 2026 budget. He pointed to numbers in the staff report suggesting that a $50 reduction could yield roughly $306,000 in savings and said he wanted a clearer understanding of the calculations. Grant noted that new provincial legislation requires municipalities to present and pass their budgets within 30 days, a shorter timeline than in previous years. Staff wanted council to have time to understand major items, he said, before entering the compressed window. The motion passed and the contract will be amended. The $150 figure will come before council for further discussion during budget meetings in January 2026. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the results of an SIU investigation into a mental health call involving the Gananoque Police.
The province's police watchdog has concluded that Gananoque Police Service officers did not commit any criminal offense during a confrontation with a man in crisis in August. According to the Special Investigations Unit, or SIU, Officers were dispatched to a local residence on the afternoon of August 15th after receiving a report of a disturbance. When they arrived, officers saw a 42-year-old man through a broken front window and attempted to calm him. The SIU said the man appeared to be in a mental health crisis and told officers that they would, quote, have to kill him, and displayed a knife. Gananoque police requested assistance from the Ontario Provincial Police as negotiations continued unsuccessfully. As the situation escalated, officers decided to enter the home. When the door was forced open, two officers fired their anti-riot weapon Enfields, or Arwins for short, striking the man. Another officer deployed a police dog, which bit the man on the right leg. The man was taken to hospital, where he was treated for bruising from the Arwin rounds and a minor dog bite that did not require stitches. After reviewing the evidence, SIU Director Joseph Martino found no reasonable grounds to believe any officer committed a criminal offense in the incident.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that report. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio with a story about a Habitat for Humanity proposal to build new affordable housing units in Bath.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Habitat for Humanity has proposed building two four-dwelling units in Bath by 2030. The units would be affordably priced through an affordable mortgage structure with the organization. According to their report, the organization's preliminary cost estimate, excluding the land, would be $1.4 million per fourplex. Funding is to come from government grants, land asset contributions, revenue from the organization's ReStore location in Kingston, donations, and fundraising events. Mortgage payments are set at 25% of the household's gross income, and families are not required to make a down payment. As part of the agreement, Habitat for Humanity retains a portion of the home's equity, and upon resale, both the homeowner and organization share in any market appreciation. Homeowners would also have to contribute 500 hours of volunteer work. If plans move forward, the company would be asking Loyalist Township for rezoning and site plan approvals, as well as exemptions for building permit fees, development charges, and impost fees. Construction of roads and services to the property line would need to take place, along with land transfers as well. The company noted these builds often involve community volunteers and student programs. These partnerships help reduce construction costs and provide training opportunities. CEO of Habitat for Humanity for the Kingston and Limestone area, Gary Lees, explained the timeline and what the company is looking to contribute.
Subject to municipal terms and conditions of land transfer, timelines to build, permits, etc., one fourplex in 2027. We've built this before. We feel confident we can pull the build off. It's so nice to build something that we've already built. It just makes life a little bit easier. So we can pull that off in 2027. I'm confident of that. And a second fourplex we would do in 2028, 2030. We'd want to work with needs a little bit as well for permitting and some of those things. Site servicing, of course, is important. Connection to municipal water and sanitary and sewer services, off-site stormwater management. All of those things need to get in place, of course, but we'll hustle and do our part with build. We will enlist volunteers to help us with the project, try to keep the costs down.
Lees spoke about the need for affordable housing.
Affordable mortgage structure, no down payment. It's a big stumbling block for folks out there is coming up with that down payment. When we're paying high rent and then we need to save so that we can put a down payment on a home, it's a daunting task. And Canadians are losing hope and vision of actual affordable home ownership. 80% of renters out there right now wish they owned their home, right? And that's a wish that's becoming very difficult. So the more equity that we can create in the home by keeping costs down, by donated product, using volunteers, anything that we can do to keep those costs down, we reinvest in building more affordable home ownership. And that's an investment in this country, this township, and our vicinity, our whole area. It's one I'm very proud of as well.
Lees spoke about the materials he has available now and the investment they'll be making in Loyalist Township.
I have containers of insulation right now. I have 400 sheets of drywall I need to get out of Home Depot's inventory. I've got stuff to build homes right here in Loyalist. And we just want to tap into that and keep the costs down so that when we sell the home to the family and then hold that mortgage at zero or a portion of the mortgage at zero, we can create as much equity as we can so we can reinvest in Loyalist and keep this ball rolling with affordable home ownership.
Lee speaks about the Restore location in Kingston and a new one opening in Napanee.
So our Restores are social entity that generate revenue, and we pump that revenue back into our home build programs. We are opening a second Restore in Napanee that opens on January 1. We'll soft open on January 1 as well. So we're going to bookend Loyalist and have you'll know where to go for your product either in Kingston or Napanee.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the Vital Signs event in Prince Edward County.
The 2025 Vital Signs report for Prince Edward County was revealed last week with some eye-opening statistics. Vital Signs coordinator Ann Van Vlack presented the recent data at a presentation in Picton, where community leaders, municipal staff, and volunteers attended to hear numbers that will shape the future of the county for health services, education, transportation, housing, and employment. Not surprising was the fact that the county has a large population of seniors, many retiring from large urban centers. But what was surprising is the data showing the exit of young people and families. There had been a quick influx of young families during the pandemic, but some are leaving and so depleting the workforce. An open discussion helped reveal reasons for the exits and what the ripple effect might cause for services, schools, health, and recreation. High on the list were career opportunities, availability of higher education, transportation, and housing. The audience broke into discussion groups to brainstorm ideas based on the data that might help shape the future of Prince Edward County. Ann Van Vlack talks about Vital Signs and what is needed. Ann, how long has Vital Signs been in existence?
In Prince Edward County, Vital Signs has been in existence since 2013. That was our first report that was published. The county foundation itself had started in 2008 locally, but we're part of 208 foundations across Canada. Many of them do Vital Signs reports and have been doing them much longer.
And what is the purpose of Vital Signs?
The purpose of Vital Signs, it's Canada's largest community-driven data collection for community well-being. So it's really taking a pulse of our community. It's not just data. I'm constantly, like you are, to a lot of community meetings and engagements and hearing it firsthand. But we collect well-being data on a lot of critical key points of health, population, community safety, food security, transportation, a lot of data in that realm. And we use that data. We don't just produce reports from it. We use it constantly with community organizations. I get requests every week from community organizations to dig a little deeper in certain parts of data. And it's helpful for informed decision making, grant applications, and advocacy.
Right. And what was the purpose for today?
Today was really meant as a starting point looking at the next community safety and well-being plan. We'll be starting to work on that next year. And it was meant to be a bit of an eye-opener because it showed new data looking at our population and demographic changes over time and the ripple effects of those changes, and that some of those patterns might reemerge. And if we can plan better for it, we're probably, the health of our community will be better if we can do some forward planning and be proactive.
And it helps the municipality and the council make decisions.
It does. It's really important that audience hears this message.
What would you like the public to know?
Really would like the public to know it's critically important that we continue to welcome newcomers to our community. If we don't have new residents moving in, and particularly young families, we're not sustaining our population. We are starting now to see our numbers decrease again, especially in the younger age groups. For those who've been here longer, they might remember that we have had a lot of school closures and lots of programs for youth and so on with our declining population. We also have a chance of losing other services. We came close to losing our local hospital a few years ago, and that was partly because of our declining population in our community. So we really, really have to find ways to remove barriers to people moving here, to workers coming here, and especially for young families. We really need the youth to help fill those classrooms and be the next, the next people in our population.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the sentencing of former teacher Kellyanne Jennings.
Kellyanne Jennings, a former Port Hope Elementary School teacher, is now behind bars after being sentenced for sex crimes against children. Justice Nathan Baker in a Lindsay court Thursday sentenced her to 4 years in prison. The sentencing request from Crown Attorney Julianne Barrett. Defense Attorney Dean Embry was advocating for a conditional sentence, sparing her any jail time. Jennings previously pleaded guilty to luring a minor through telecommunications and child pornography. She communicated with three former students through Snapchat. Jennings sent half-nude and full-nude photos of herself, as well as videos of her touching herself, including masturbation, to the victims. She requested that the victims, too, send her naked photos and videos as well. The victims did send photos and videos. The third victim forwarded the Snapchat material to Port Hope Police, who opened an investigation and eventually arrested her in August 2024. Investigators alleged at that time that a boy came forward accusing her of inappropriate touching on a school trip. The incidents are alleged to have occurred between June 2022 and April 2024, all taking place in the Port Hope area. Justice Baker stated that a custodial sentence reflected the severity of the crimes committed and the ongoing harm to the children victims. He said children are vulnerable and deserve protection and respect and should not be used by adults for sexual gratification. There is a publication ban in effect to protect the identities of the victims. Embry denied interviewing or issuing a statement when court concluded. Jennings showed no emotion or remorse as she was taken into custody to begin serving her sentence. She will be placed on the sex offender registry for life following a period of probation. She is also prohibited from attending public parks, swimming pools, daycares, or any setting where children under the age of 16 are expected to be present, and she is barred from gaining employment where she has authority over children under the age of 16. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, December 4th, daytime high of -1, but a bone-chilling low of -12. It's going to be sunny, but it is going to be very cold with high wind chill. Friday, December 5th, daytime high of -5 with a 60% chance of snow throughout the day. Going to feel like -11 with the wind chill. Saturday, December 6th, daytime high of -2, overnight low of -10 with periods of snow throughout the day. Sunday, December 7th, daytime high of -3, feeling closer to zero, so a little warmer than the days before it. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, December 8th, a mix of sleet and freezing rain on the morning of December 8th, high of -4, low of -7, so it's going to be chilly and there is going to be precipitation. Might be worthwhile doing a school bus watch. Keep your eye on the tri board for any announcements of bus cancellations.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st. Help us raise $25,000 to support our local arts and artists and keep our community informed with local news, concerts, and event listings on air and on our website. Visit CFRC.ca today and make your gift to Kingston's longest-running broadcaster serving our community since 1922. Get a tax receipt via Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. For every $5 donated, you get one more chance to win. Thank you for your support.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. I'm Adam, joined by Sam and Kyle. We're going to start out talking today about McGill University's track program that just got doubled down, shut down, despite a major push from supporters, athletes, and families of the athletes. It still got shut down, and that's going into effect next year. They actually just had their season opener this week, so I guess their last season, they started out pretty hot. They hosted a meet at their facility in Montreal, and it went pretty well for them. They were getting a lot of social media traction. I remember I saw their post up on my feed and had something like 800 comments on it. I've never seen that on like a university like let alone university track and field, but a university sports account. So it's getting pretty big. Sam, what's it like in Montreal? I know you said you knew a few people that used to be on the team, and I'm assuming they're trying to fight for it. But what's it like?
It's definitely a bit shocking and a bit weird. I don't think too many people anticipating this being the result of current ongoing issues between the provincial government and McGill's administration. But people are pretty upset about it. So Kyle and I think you also met him before too, Adam. I know this guy named Olivier who goes to McGill, and he ran track. And then I met a few of his friends. But I can tell you they're all pretty shocked as well. This seems like it came out of nowhere. I think they were kind of caught off guard. The women's rugby team also got shut down. McGill's women's rugby team wasn't particularly good, but it's just weird that that would happen at a time when Canada's national women's team is the best in the world, probably indisputably the best in the world at the present moment too. And I know that they do a lot with Rugby Canada, so I'm just not really sure what's going to come of all this. It seems like the only things that McGill was really able to protect and that they chose to protect were intramural sports or club sports, as they call them here, and the hockey teams. So yeah. Those were clearly the priorities. I don't really know what to say about it. I will tell you this, though. People are actually pretty depressed on campus. Yeah. I wasn't expecting people to be that upset. Usually people aren't that in tune with their school spirit or with their sports teams, but I think that reality is slowly starting to set in, that McGill is coming to an impasse with other entities that it's bargaining with, and it's having a real ramification in very manifestable ways.
Yeah, sometimes you don't realize what you have until it's gone, right? And I think that that's kind of the case. We've talked about it before on the podcast about how low school spirit is around, like, even Queens with certain of their sports teams. But I think that this is, like, really showing that sports play a very valuable part of, like, student life and student morale. And it's just very disheartening to see. Kyle, any thoughts on McGill shutting down or why they might be stuck in this situation?
I mean, I think they're in a situation where they are trying to save every bit of money they currently can, because right now they're currently subsidizing undergrad for out of province students and people that, basically anyone out of province. mm-hmm. To try to maintain fees at what they used to be previous. So they're just bleeding money doing that sort of thing, right? And they only have a couple of years of that that they can keep it going. So I guess they're just trying to cut any kind of expenses. To be honest, though, the thing that bothers me about it is that I just don't understand how track and field is like a major expense. I mean, in the grand scheme of things of a university, and like on the scale of like money that they're spending and, you know, their expenses they have, like, I just don't see how that's even a drop in the pond. But
yeah,
apparently it is, I guess.
Yeah, I know from even like personal experience, like the track and field and cross country programs are definitely not the most funded. They aren't the money makers, that's for sure. And they don't really need that much money to function compared to like other sports that need the equipment and facilities like football. It's definitely seems like they cut out a big chunk of them. I was also surprised to see like the men's volleyball team, women's rugby, as Sam mentioned, the golf team. They really did take out a huge majority of the smaller sports. And it is very sad to see. But Sam, do you see this becoming a trend? Do you think that as other universities go into a little more debt, which seems to be a common occurrence, I mean, even here at Queens with us running a deficit, do you think that that is something that might impact other Ontario or Canadian schools?
I mean, yeah, I do. I know this opinion is probably a little unwarranted, but I do think that a lot of institutions are going to have to come to a difficult decision really soon as to whether they want to invest in certain things or other things. And I mean, sports might be the chopping block. The thing is, the universities in Canada and like the United States are much more focused and prioritized on upkeeping their academic reputation. Their athletic reputation matters far, far less, which is why we don't give out full scholarships in youth sports, whereas the NCAA does. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, as things start to get bad economically speaking, and as institutions keep digging themselves into a deeper and deeper hole, which has been happening particularly in Ontario because of legislation by the provincial government, which has frozen tuition increases over the past couple years, they're gonna be forced to cut in some places. I mean, I don't think anywhere's gonna be as drastic as McGill. Mm-hmm. Like this is like, let's be frank, let's call it what it is. It's a spade to spade. This is insanely drastic. And this is an unprecedented cut in sport funding. Yeah. But I mean, I'm just saying this is a wake up call in my view to other universities. So I would just say this to any student listening. If you want sports to be on campus, just go watch the game and show them you care. If you show them that you care, they're not going to cut the funding. They'll cut funding from something else that's kind of less important that they haven't yet figured out they're spending money on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a lot of the times tickets are free to these games, or as long as you bring a student card, like, you can get in for free. So really, it's not too much out of your pocket either to go and spend a few hours supporting the school team. Moving on to the NHL, we saw some trends going down in the Eastern Conference over the past week. We saw Florida take quite the hit. They've fallen down to second last in the Eastern Conference. And I knew the Alex Barkov loss was going to be huge for this team, but they honestly had proved me wrong throughout the first few games of the season. They were up in the top three in a wild card spot for a bit, and now it just seems to be a little bit of a fall off. Is this just a stutter, or do you think that the real life effects of not having your captain are settling in?
Yeah, I mean, they're the LTIR Florida Panthers. I mean, there's just so many injuries there, like... No, I'm not really surprised. Not to mention there's injuries, but keep in mind, like, they've had two long seasons, so they're extra tired on top of that, essentially. So they're pretty worn out. I still think they could make the playoffs. I wouldn't write them off 100%.
Yeah.
But that's kind of mostly counting on like a resurgence on the, you know, last quarter of the season with some returning players and whatnot.
Yeah, no, I agree. Who do you think has a better chance of sneaking in? Toronto, who's in last in the East, or Florida? Because I know those are two teams that we didn't really expect to be at the bottom of the pile, but here we are, December 1st or December 2nd, and that's what the season's looking like.
I think it's a bit of toss up there. I mean, I would say injuries will play a big part on who squeezes who out there. Mm-hmm. If Toronto gets another major injury on any of their key players, they're toasty, though. Yeah. I mean, even with all their good players, they're probably they're close to being on the margins there.
Yeah, I agree.
I saw some like kind of crazy post that was just trying to say that Matthew Knives has more points than Marner. And I was like, well, okay. But, you know, he has one more point than him. But I don't know. This is silly. Like, would you rather have one or both? Probably both.
Yeah, I don't think they're sitting in the same spot right as they are right now if they do have Mitch Marner on the team. I think that's probably the best way of putting it from what we've seen so far this season. Sam, any thoughts on Florida and Toronto?
I mean, probably the same as you guys. I'm just really happy that they're doing less good than usual. But to be fair, too, I do think Florida is on the downfall anyways. I know they still have good players, but you can only be good for so long. I don't know. I'm just saying this is a psychological thing more than anything. Like, they should still be really good.
Yeah.
But eventually they're going to start losing games. Like, look how often Montreal choked in the past when they had really good players on their team after they'd won. But it's true. I mean, seriously, Montreal was the best team in the world. And then after they won a couple Stanley Cups in a row, they just have a really crappy season out of nowhere. This is a psychological thing. Toronto, on the other hand, are a bunch of poo head players and fan base. But I mean, look, Toronto, I don't think is actually that good. I think they're really overrated. I think they have a horrible decor. And I think that they are a one-line team offensively. So I don't think there's any reason to say they're on the rise or that they should be at the top. They are a very mediocre hockey team, and they're playing mediocre hockey. Therefore, they are playing badly.
Yeah, fair enough.
I have it. Parade canceled.
Parade for McKenna might be start getting planned though.
Oh man!
You know, I heard you can already buy McKenna jerseys.
Oh, well, really? That doesn't surprise me at all.
They have them listed at number 00.
Were you guys able to see that Voronkov and Brendan Dillon fight? It was Brendan Dillon's 1,000th game in the NHL, and there was a bit of a scrum in front of the net, and Voronkov dropped the gloves with Dillon, and it was a very scary looking fall. Voronkov took Dillon to the ice, and Dillon had like the Tua Tagovailoa hands going on, like it looks like he was putting up gang signs, and was very, very slow to get up. We haven't seen too many fights this year during the NHL season, and I think that's like obviously a trend we've talked about, but I really think that this is kind of proof why they don't want to encourage fighting as much in especially Major Junior, but even now in the NHL. Because Brendan Dillon was well on his way to having a good game. And honestly, it wasn't even that dirty of a fight, but it was the fall to the ice that really, really sent it in. They think he banged his head off the ice. Any thoughts on that? And I know Sheldon Keefe was really upset with that, the Devils coach, just because of how unnecessary it seemed. I mean, it was just a little bit of a snow shower on the goalie after the play. But is this like a kind of like reinforcing the thought that we need to maybe watch how we're fighting in the NHL?
I mean, concussions are a funny thing, right? Like, you can actually, it's actually almost easier to get a concussion from hitting the ice than someone just clobbering you in the head just because of the way your brain moves in your skull, you know, when you hit the ice like that. So they're finicky. I mean, the problem is the concussions and head injuries are just always going to be some part of the game. Mm-hmm. No matter what way you play it, really.
Yeah.
I saw there was another fight with, I can't remember the guy's name, but he's on Philly, and the guy, he's like 6'9". He's huge.
Huh.
That was a scary fight. He destroyed the other guy.
Yeah. I've been seeing a lot.
I wouldn't want to fight that guy.
I've been seeing a lot of fights in the AHL, and I know it's the same rules in the NHL that you can't like take the helmet off, right? But these guys have such bloody knuckles after these fights from punching out a visor in a helmet. I don't really understand. Like, obviously, I understand it protects the head a lot more. But why are these guys still doing it if they're going to bust up their hands? Because, I mean, like, there's some pretty brutal looking, like, the fights are honestly bloodier than, like, some of the fights that I've seen in the past because of, like, the hand-to-helmet contact. Sam, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was actually just about to say, I kind of think not being allowed to take your helmet off is more dangerous than being allowed to take it off. Because think of it like this, too. Say you punch someone in the side and their earpiece shatters and goes in their ear and shatters I don't know, like whatever's inside your ear that lets you hear a noise. I feel like that's just a really bad idea. Sorry, I forget all the terminology for this stuff. It's been a while since I took grade 7 biology, but you know, I don't know. I just think it's kind of stupid. And also, like, yeah, blood looks cooler when you're fighting, but I don't think that that's a good reason to keep a helmet on when you're bashing someone's head with your fist. Like, my point is, if you're going to punch someone in the head, why would you also try and allow yourself to get punched in the head and then also hurt your hand when you could just punch someone in the head and get punched in the head without hurting your hand? And beyond that, too, and this is, sorry, I mean, I know that argument's kind of stupid, but when you really think about it, it's stupider to punch someone in the head with your gloves off with a helmet on than to just, like, either you keep your gloves on or you take everything off. There should be no in between. Yeah, like, if the NHL wants guys to punch each other in the face with their gloves on, that's fine. I mean, it's going to look like people are doing buckets of gloves but on the ice, and it's going to be a lot lamer than usual. But that's okay. I mean, it's allowed to be like that. But, I think the moral of the story really should be that the NHL's forgotten what the purpose of fighting actually ever was. Mm-hmm. Fighting has always been in hockey, and its job, its place, its duty was to protect really good players from really crappy ones like me, who were enforcers and goons who were there to hurt them. And so what we do is you'd get a good player who could also fight to go and beat the crap out of the other guy who was doing dirty stuff behind the play that the ref couldn't see. The NHL has de facto removed that. And statistically speaking, since there have been less fighting, there's been many, many more major injuries in the NHL. And I get that everyone wants to protect you. You know, everyone wants to protect each other's heads, but unfortunately, there's no correlation between keeping a helmet on when you fight and taking one off and the amount of head injuries you can get. They actually appear to be the exact same. If anything, we're just wasting blood on the ice and punching visors and helmets and breaking fists. So, I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. Like, look, if the NHL is saying that guys won't be able to write after they play in the NHL and get punched in the head so much, they should also consider that you're not able to write when your hand is so mangled from punching a helmet so much throughout your entire career. Fortunately, the outcome is the same.
No, it's not a terrible take. I kind of see where you're coming from with it. I do think it's funny. So I don't know if you guys have checked out the PWHL recently, but they are thinking about introducing body checking and full hitting into that league, which would be the first professional women's league to have body checking, which I honestly didn't even know that was the case. But even in like international hockey, there is no body checking in women's hockey. So I find it kind of ironic that the NHL is moving away from less physicality, but the PWHL is moving towards more. Kyle, any thoughts on that?
I think the problem, like, you know, we're talking about a fundamental change to the game. Mm-hmm. I kind of hope they're doing their due diligence on this, because this is like the equivalent. I mean, you know, even in when you're younger, you know, there's a point where you're too young to have contact, right? And then you transition into having contact. But like, you know, women's hockey development currently doesn't do that. So your transition is from playing high level hockey to suddenly having contact at the highest level of hockey. You're bound to have some wicked injuries doing that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it sounds nice on paper, but you kind of have to line yourself up. Like, you know, if the NHL did the same thing where we removed 100% of hitting in OHL, and then also, and, you know, NCAA is pretty light on hitting, but, you know, it was non-contact in the AHL or something all the way up to NHL, only the NHL was contact. Like, it would be a bit wild out there.
Yeah.
No one's really properly trained on how to hit, and they are not used to taking hits. They don't even, like, they're not used to playing hockey with hitting. And it also changes the dynamic of the game completely.
Yeah.
Like, women's hockey currently, it doesn't really matter size of defenseman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of open-ended. It's just more skill-based. And, you know, I guess the NHL is a little bit like that. But at the end of the day, like, defensemen are bigger. Like, there is a size factor. So it actually will effectively, clear out some defensemen from their league. I don't know if they're thinking about it that way right now, but it will.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. Sam, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess respectfully, I have a bit of a contrary ear, like, I guess a different view to the contrary. But I don't know. Like, if you watch the PWHL, you'll notice they do hit each other quite a bit on the boards, and they actually just kind of throw the body anyways. I don't really think it's going to change that much.
Fair
enough. Like, just, the refs are going to have less to do. It's not like they were calling penalties anyways. But if you really watch women's hockey at the highest level, except for an international competition, if you watch them play at the highest level in the PWHL, and, well, actually, the PWHL used to be their OHL. They have a different name for it now. I just forget what it is. But they do throw the body. So I don't know if it's going to make a big difference. I think the real big difference is just going to come from the open ice hitting that's permitted. Like, those have pretty much always been called. So I agree with Kyle on that. That's going to change the game a lot. Like, no more will the 5'1", 4'11" defenseman be able to stand up to the 5'9" Mahifidi Puna cutting across the middle.
Yeah.
So it is going to change a lot.
No, for sure.
What do you think, Adam?
I think it's very similar to what you said, Sam. I think I really like Kyle's point about how it's going to eliminate certain size defensemen, because even it doesn't really matter how skilled you are. If you're like a middle skilled but short defenseman, I feel like that you're immediately kind of losing your place to a larger defender that can throw the body in center ice. I also think that this is going to I feel like they're going to have to change the way that youth hockey works for women now if they are going to implement this. Because, again, I feel like it's honestly more dangerous having people play that don't know what they're doing when it comes to hitting and are just, like, out there, like, running around with their heads cut off, right? Like, it's that's more dangerous than anything. So I do think that there needs to be, like, education put on even at a young age. So it'll be completely different. It'll also be interesting to see how they turn it off when it comes to international play. Because if you get so used to playing a certain way in the pro leagues, and then you're expected to go and play even a more like competitive, aggressive, like rivalry filled game, and you automatically can't hit, that's going to be a kind of a game changer. I think you definitely see increased penalty minutes in the international competitions, and that can sometimes take away from the actual skill that they want to show. But I do think it is an interesting way to kind of level the playing field with the men's league, because they don't want to be too different, right? But one thing that I always thought women's had like on the men's leagues was that it looks a lot more skillful when they're playing. I mean, even like some of the international games, I remember like them being able to like do all this fancy deking and stuff, like while not have to worry about getting hit, was kind of fun to watch. Like, it was different, and I think that that's why I liked it, is because it wasn't the exact same as the men's game. But now I feel like it's kind of just going to kind of become a little more broad, I guess. It's going to be just kind of the same thing, just obviously at different intensity levels and different hitting levels. Because I still think we're going to see big hits, but I mean, I don't think they're going to be like Zdeno Chara out there leveling Max Pacioretty-esque players into the turnstile. But it will be interesting to see how it goes. And it will be, I don't know if it's been passed already or if that's something that they're moving forward with, but it'll be interesting to see if there's any pushback as well. Moving on to some players that definitely have some pushback about them playing in the NHL. Two of the Hockey Canada trial players have been assigned to professional teams in the men's league. Carter Hart has been in the AHL for the last few weeks. His suspension ended today, and Vegas immediately called him up. So that's an interesting to see his reception going with the fans. I mean, I feel like he's going to be berated by fans at every opposing stadium that he goes to. It'll also be interesting to see how he plays after having not played for a year and a half. Cal Foote is another player, defenseman. He got picked up by the Chicago Wolves, who are the AHL affiliate for the Carolina Hurricanes. Now, he's not on a Hurricanes contract. He's on an AHL contract, so he right now can't be moved up to the NHL. But at the time of his suspension, he was with the Syracuse Crunch of the AHL, so he was kind of in the AHL already. But it'll be interesting to see if he can make an NHL comeback, and again, what the response is like. I sense some booing every time these players touch the puck in these guys' future. But any thoughts, Sam, Kyle, about these two players and maybe even some of the other ones? I know Dylan Dubé is still unsigned. Alex Formanton started a Euro comeback, and McLeod as well is still trying to fight their way back into the NHL.
I don't know. I think a lot, I mean, to be honest, the coverage of this is infinitely bigger in Canada than the U.S. So most American markets don't even honestly don't know anything about it. So I honestly don't see them having problems there, but certainly in Canada games, they'll probably have some issues. I mean, Carter Hart, he's played 3 games in the AHL. He's averaging 3 goals against with a .839, which is real low. You know, bit of a mixed bag there. I don't really know what to expect. I think Vegas is just kind of rolling the dice there, seeing if maybe he pans out, maybe he doesn't. They'll just kind of dump him. Otherwise, I have a feeling he'll be mediocre. I don't think he's going to come out flying with these like unbelievable stats, if I'm being honest. Maybe, at least not this season. I think there's no way. Training hard all off season with the team and coming back next season, maybe you'd have a bit of a rebound, but as of now, no.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Sam, any thoughts on Foot or Hart?
Well, yeah, I mean, I suspect Hart's going to end up sticking around and playing in the NHL because I think he was probably the best of all the guys, in my view. I don't think Cal Foot's going to go back up to this. The thing is, it all depends on how much hockey they actually played when they were out of the league. I feel like they weren't playing that much hockey, if I had to guess. I don't know. It's just a lot up in the air. But Kyle's right, though. The Americans don't really know what happened. Yeah. And they don't really care. I mean, the thing, too, is that you got to remember, there's a lot of guys in the NHL who were arrested for a variety of things. I think we've said it on the podcast before, maybe in a more jestful way, but Patrick Kane was arrested for a slew of things. Drew Doughty was arrested and accused of similar things as well, actually more egregious ones, probably, many people would say. So was Jordan Staal. Like, I don't know what to say. I mean, the thing is, when it comes to hockey, for whatever reason, teams certainly have a lot more leniency. And it might be true in other pro sports in the world, but in North America, it does seem like hockey gets the rep for being the most lenient when it comes to stuff like this. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if these guys end up playing in the NHL if they're good enough. But the key thing is not like that they may have done something wrong. The key thing is that they may not be good enough to play in the NHL now that they've been out for so long. That is the key element here, and I don't know if people recognize that.
But I mean, also, I feel like the pressure too, and the media scrutiny, especially if one of them gets signed to a Canadian team, I think that can have a huge impact on your play as well.
Maybe, but it didn't seem to bother Logan Mailloux in Montreal.
No, that is a fair point. That is absolutely a fair point. I do think that there is a difference in severity to what Logan Mailloux did than to these players. And it's very, like, it's very publicized in Canada. Like, all the court records are open. Everyone knows exactly what happened that night according to the court documents. And, like, that's, like, unlimited ammo for people that want to heckle or want to get in a player's head. Like, that's a huge thing for him, and I do think that it might play a factor, but I honestly think that these guys are, again, not the highest quality players, maybe aside from Hart, so I don't think a lot of these guys are gonna have to worry about it. But I do think Carter Hart, if he plays in Canada, like the away games in Canada, I don't know what you do. I don't think you start him, but I don't even know if you have him on the bench. Like, he might have to be a press box guy, because I can't imagine the guys around the away, opposing fans around the bench are going to be very nice to Carter Hart, if you know what I mean. So I think it'll be interesting to see. One more thing before we wrap up for the night. Monday Night Football, we watched, Kyle actually sent this to our group chat. It was the Giants and the Patriots were playing, and it was a one-sided Patriots win. Kind of expected. The Patriots are really good this year. First team to 11 wins. The Giants are really bad this year. They've fired their head coach. I think they have 2 wins or 3 wins. So very lopsided matchup going on Monday Night Football. But there was one kick attempt from Youngway Koo, and it has to be the worst kick attempt I think I have ever seen. I think he must have kicked it. He missed the ball and probably kicked 1 foot ahead of the ball. Kyle, you think that's right on the measurement?
He slipped. I mean, they got to test the guy for performance unenhancing drugs or something, man. He took something serious, but it did not have the effect intended.
Yeah, he bet the under on a field goals attempted or something, field goals made, because that was a brutal thing to watch. And you don't see that anywhere. But I was talking to Sam before the podcast, and we were talking about how quick of a how short of a leash kickers are on in the NFL, because they're all so replaceable. Like, there's probably like two or three kickers that like can get away with missing like 2 to 3 field goals in a game and then not be cut the next week. But like, this is brutal. I mean, already a struggling team, and now your kicker is doing that. Like, that cannot help. But it's quite the business, and it's tough being a kicker in the NFL. So it'll be interesting to see if the Giants hold on to Koo, or if he's looking elsewhere for a job next week. But that is all the time that we have today. We will see you next week. I think next week's probably gonna be our last episode before the Christmas break. But we hope you enjoyed this one, and we will see you next week.
Flex that musical muscle memory if you got.